chair of the GNSO Council, and I do again welcome all of you here. I do want to remind everyone, when you do speak, for the sake of the transcribers and the recording, that you would please give your name when you do that, unless your name has been given in advance. For those that are dialing in for this, please remember to unmute your line, or to mute your lines when you're not speaking. Also, I want to go over the GNSO meeting protocol that we're using for the meetings this week. Some of you, I'm sorry, I've probably heard this two or three times. You'll probably hear it several more times, but our sessions are open to everyone, as was visibly evident in our last session. And the GNSO working sessions are not official council meetings. We don't make any official decisions on these. We will make any decisions we make on our in our open public meeting on Wednesday morning, and you're all welcome to be there for that. And there will be opportunity in that meeting for comment at various points through the meeting as well. In most cases, before we act on a motion, give the opportunity for councilors to speak first, as I said prior to the start of the meeting. But then as we have time, we will allow comments from the floor. I would just ask that you come up to the front of the center aisle there and take a mic. Do we have the mics now working, Glenn? We're not going to need them for a little bit, but we want to make sure last session they did not work, so we might want to check that out so that when we get to that point, that's available. I would ask you to be brief in your comments and to the point so that there is opportunity for everyone, and that goes for counselors too. If we can be as brief and concise as possible, that will help us have opportunity for everyone that wants to speak. I may at some point limit the time that people speak just to make sure that we give full opportunity to everyone. And I'll also try and favor those who have not had opportunity to speak. All that said, let me turn it over to someone we know well and have been working with on this issue for how many years, Kurt? I lost track. Too many. Okay, for those that couldn't see it in the back. Kurt, welcome, and Karen, welcome as well. We appreciate your participation in this and willingness to be here and interact with us.
Great. Thank you, Chuck, and thank you, everybody, for taking the time to discuss this. I think the genesis of this sort of meeting goes back to the policy development process when the GNSO Council held many sessions to develop the policy for releasing new top-level domains and consulted with staff regarding the implementability of certain policy positions. And then the tradition continues now as during the implementation of that policy, ICANN staff consults with the GNSO to check whether the implementation as it's envisaged in the guidebook meets the goals of the policy recommendation. So I think that's the goal here, as well as to promote understanding about the process for launching new top-level domains. So understanding and raising issues as we continue to hone the model. So if we could go to the two, ICANN now has two introductory slides for its presentations. So growing up, so I just want to start with, I think the big message is really not about new GTLDs specifically. It's more about the ICANN process and the recent successes we've seen. Is that in focus? To you guys? Okay, so.
Hello.
It's okay. So I'll continue. I'm sorry. So it's really about a success, the ICANN model. In a short period of time over the past months, we've convened a significant number of working groups out of the community, cross-constituency, cross-stakeholder working groups with not necessarily identical or parallel views on all these issues, and convene the groups, develop positions, develop consensus positions that are now part of the new GTLD application process. And so, you know, names like IRT, STI, ZFA, HSTLD, TGL, IDNWT, you know, worked on things like the PDDERP and the RRDRP. And, but you know, we talk about how long it takes to develop policy and how tough the model is because there's opposing viewpoints, but when required to work hard and make accommodation, in the past few months, the trademark protections and some IDN solutions and malicious conduct mitigation solutions that are in the guidebook really came from places like this. So I think the big message for you know that I get to talk about to kind of deflect attention from the guidebook detail itself is to really talk about the ICANN public participation model. And you certainly have my thanks for all the hard work. So what I think the best way to run this, and I'm very flexible, mirrors what we've done in the past. So we want to talk. I think we can take comments about each section of the guidebook. So kind of parse it up that way. So it's not one 3-hour section of comments here. And then in addition to the modules, we can also talk about some other publication and efforts that are going on that are new GTLD related but not guidebook related, such as the new GTLD budget, the applicant support group, and then the resolution of the other overarching issues that aren't part of the guidebook, the economic study and root zone scaling. So what I propose, and I'll stop if somebody has a better idea, is for each of the modules 1 through 5, I'll give a very brief overview of what's in that module, and 2, what's changed in that module in this new version of the guidebook. And then if we could kind of tailor comments and questions to that module. It's really tough for the first module because that's kind of a overview itself. So, but if we could kind of tailor it to the topics we discussed. So if that's okay with everybody, it's okay with everybody. We'll go on to the did you have something to say, Adrian? Or, Chuck, you're running this meeting, right? And then so if you would.
Okay. Adrian? Yeah.
I just question whether we need to be told what's in each module as opposed to what's changed in each module. I think you could probably just go to what's changed in each module
I think that was your intent, was it not?
Yeah. Well, it's all in the same slide, so I'll try not to waste your time.
You asked, I answered.
Yeah. The purpose of it is to kind of tailor the questions. So I will. So let's trudge on. Applicant Guidebook Version 4. So Module 1, like I said, is an overview, but it really identifies the process stages, who can apply, what the string requirements are, IDN requirements, how much you got to pay, and sections that were updated in this module had to do with vertical integration. I'm sure everyone here is aware of that. Also refinements to variant management, IDN various management, and some aspects of process development. Go ahead. So with regard to vertical integration, this slide combined with the experiences in this room speaks for itself. But vertical integration section in the guidebook, is who can apply, and essentially, co-ownership registry and registrar is essentially barred. It's a default position, and we know that there's developmental work going on with the vertical integration group that's just been laboring away. Meetings twice a week and a mailing list that's fantastic, and then the work that's done here. I'll say that the provisions in Module 1 in the guidebook and in the registry agreement were very carefully worded, and so If there's questions as to what those mean, I think the answer is going to be that if it's not clear in what's written, then that would be a good comment to make to the guidebook, and we shouldn't try to iron out what it means in here, but rather we should take comments and take the sum of those comments and try to make it clear. I think what's not on this slide is that the board, in its resolution and follow-on work, has left the door open itself to amending this, but it awaits awaits the work of the vertical integration working group. And then, so next slide, variant management. There's some clarification there, but it hasn't changed much. In this round, variant TLD strings, and I assume we know what we're talking about there, but I can define them as best I can, will not be delegated in this round. They'd be essentially allocated or reserved. That's not the right word, is it, Karen? We don't use that word anymore. But not delegated, pending the resolution of the development of a technical solution for delegation of variant strings, and that we're exploring those technical solutions through study of DNAME and other solutions. And then finally, some refinements to the process. better definition around timelines, better clarification and timing of the public comment process and the role that plays in the evaluation, a code of conduct for evaluators that's been requested in the public comments, and some more detail about the application system. So I think is that the last slide of that section? So if there's questions about Module 1, let's start.
Okay, like I said before, we're going to start with the council, and then we'll form a queue in the middle of the room there behind Kurt. And I have Adrian to start it off, and Zahid. Okay. And I have Edmund as well. Let me just look. Christina. And I'll look to my left. Stefan. Okay. Any other hands on the council right now? There'll be more opportunity, but let's start it off with Adrian, please.
Thanks, Kurt. Can I draw your attention to 1.2.1 with respect to restrictions on registrar cross ownership? It's at 1-19 on that page on the red line version, at least. It's a simple question, and I should also say, I think the staff have done an excellent job on this version of the applicant guidebook, for the record. So the second to last paragraph on that page starts with further applications where the applicant has engaged an ICANN accredited registrar or reseller. Are you with me on that paragraph? Mm-hmm. There is a reference made on the second last line there to any registry services. This is a term we see later on in the contract. Should that registry services, just for the sake of consistency, be capitalised and then refer to the defined registry services? Because when it's not capitalised, it's potentially, unless it is your, to make a question out of this then, is it your intention to be broader than the registry services that is capitalised in the contract? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think so. Dan, you're hiding behind that post back there, right?
But deliberately.
Is this the registry services as defined by, defined by the funnel, or should we refine the guidebook to make a definition out of registry services so it's clear what the definition is? And while Dan is looking at that, he's also sent me an IM that says that I'm just giving an overview of the draft and doing my best, but applicants should rely only on the final written text. But seriously, we do this in a really collaborative, collegial style, in an effort to promote understanding and raise issues in an efficient way, rather than throwing comments back and forth across the wall. And I'm bound to be somewhat off in my explanation. So I'm going to take your point and look into defining with specificity what, you know, with registry services. So every time you see the term registry services, you know exactly what it means.
Right, because it is a concern if it's more broad reaching than what you have used it elsewhere. I think you've been very good at defining it elsewhere. Thank you.
Okay, we have next Zahid.
Thanks, Kurt. This is on page 1-5, 1.1.2.3. There's new language that says applications will be selected randomly for each batch. However, measures will be taken to ensure that all contending strings are in the same batch. I just wanted to know how this will work, and does this effectively mean categorization? And if not, just generally get an idea of how this works. That's one question. The second, very short one, is I see in 1-35 and 1-36, this is 1.4.1.1, user registration, the tasks, basically. Just a general question. It says that no new user registration will be accepted after, and it says date to be inserted in the final DAG. So does that mean that if you, even after this deadline has expired, to not be, you know, to become a TAS registrant, can you still apply before the deadline? Or if you cannot, can slots be transferred? And is there a possibility of trading these slots?
And just before you respond, Kurt, maybe you want to set the context a little bit for the first question, in that if there are an excessive amount of applications, is what when that applies.
Thank you for that, Chuck and Zahid. Yeah. So that's exactly the case for in the event that there's more than about 500 applications, we think for quality control and consistency reasons that we wouldn't want to process applications in batches greater than 500. So we've done a study of the resources required to process applications in a given period of time. And, you know, it's from a couple of guidebooks ago, but I think, you know, to process 500 would require in the period of time that we advertise, which I think is 4 months or something like that, would require 75 technical evaluators. And given the bandwidth of the firms we're working for, the potential service providers we're working with, the availability they have for evaluators, we think that having more than 75 evaluators would cause a beginning of loss of quality control of consistency over the process. So working with those potential service providers, we've drawn a dashed line that says, if we need more than 75 evaluators, i.e. if we have more than 500 applications, we really want to batch those so we can ensure consistency across the scoring of all the applications. So having said that, the guidebook says we want to develop a random way of selecting how the batches are drawn. So looking at first come, first serve, or random selection, or some sort of prioritization or categorization. At this point, and there's some legal checks to be made, that a random selection is the preferred way to do that selection. But we might have contention sets, right? There might be similar strings or identical strings, and it wouldn't make sense to have those in separate batches. So after we do the random selection, then we would say promote all the applications in that contention set to the first batch, so that that we don't do an evaluation, and then it's really meaningless because it's contending with another application. And then I don't know if Karen can help me on your second question, but the really short answer is there'll be a really well-defined, bright-line cutoff date for applying because of legal checks and that have to be done even before fees are accepted. There has to be sort of a two-stage application process where you apply for a name, you get a name, you say you want to pay fees. ICANN goes through and say, okay, this guy can pay fees to ICANN, and then the application becomes real. So that first date, where applying for access to TAS, I hope I'm getting this right, will be the bright line cutoff date, but it'll be in big bold letters in the guidebook. You know, if you want to play, you know, you need to apply for a application slot by this date. As far as transferring slots, you know, again, if Dan has something to add on this, it would be great. We see it as difficult to absolutely prevent some sort of transfers. You know, firms can apply for a GTLD and then become acquired, and so there's many ways in which there can be combinations after the fact, and so you know, an absolute prohibition on transfers is really hard to accomplish because the rules can be gamed. I don't know, Dan, if you have anything to add to that.
No, I guess I would just add that I don't think it's our intent to build a system where there's going to be like an open market in slots for applications. But
that's correct.
But definitely we should take comment on that. Maybe if people have suggestions for how to control that. Like Kurt said, we can't completely stop a company from being bought just because it has an application pending. But at the same time, we don't want to make this kind of open market for that.
Yeah, let me remind everyone that you have to be fairly close to these microphones to be heard, and keep in mind anybody participating remotely, listening in that way or in the recording, et cetera. So please be fairly close to the microphones. Okay, our next person in queue is Edmund.
Thank you, Chuck. I've two questions. One on IDN variants. I congratulate staff for including it finally into consideration. I sort of hope I didn't. I got wrong that Kurt, you mentioned that the variants will not be delegated in the whole round. I guess you mean that once the mechanism is there, we would be able to delegate the variants as well, and not that the whole round all the applicants won't be able to do it. And also I want to bring this up because this is obviously a very important issue. As we observe from the IDN CCTLD fast track, it is a critical issue for in the case of China .China, it was a critical issue, and I think it will be a critical issue for new GTLDs, especially Chinese new GTLDs as well. So I think it is a matter that needs to be resolved. So I want to understand where we are with the experience with the IDN CCTLD fast track, and also whether the synchronized IDN TLD would be applicable for GTLDs as well. And if not, we really need to get it together, because it is a critical issue for IDN TLDs. The second item is, I'm sure you're aware of the discussion about applying a same applicant or same registry operator applying for a confusingly similar string. In the case of contention sets, if an applicant apply for two or more, which could be considered confusingly similar strings, how we deal with it in the contention set, and whether it could be all delegated in whatever form. So I think that needs to be worked on as well as we progress in that particular discussion. So those are the two questions or comments.
Thanks, Edmund. So what the guidebook says is that a variant string wouldn't be delegated to someone else. That if you applied for a string and applied for the variant, your preferred string would be delegated, and that the variant would not be delegated, but would not be delegated to anybody else. And then pending a technical solution such as DNAME or BNAME or some other thing that I don't understand. For ensuring that URLs of variants resolve essentially to the same place, once that solution is developed and tested, that the variant could then be delegated. So it could happen, that technical solution could happen, it's going to be a while before we delegate GTLD. So It could be developed before they're delegated or sometime during the first round. And then as soon as that solution's available, then variants can be delegated. And so I think that so my limited understanding of this issue is that variants are really a subset. Nah, they're not a subset of confusingly similar names. Sometimes a variant might not be confusing with the name, but sometimes it would. But so the way the guidebook's written now is that confusingly similar names, like two strings causing user confusion, likely to result in user confusion, would not be delegated. You know, I know the discussion that's going on in the GNSO right now, and there's a letter out for public comment that's going to energize that issue. And I think, so frankly, when we talk about that, so we see what you post too. And so we're trying to determine how to get involved in that issue, whether we should comment in the comment period, whether we should wait to receive the letter. And maybe we can talk some more about that outside of this as that discussion continues.
Kurt, just to clarify something, and Edmund, I'll let you do it too. But so is it correct for people to understand, for potential applicants to understand, that if they do eventually want to have variants, that they should include that in the application with the understanding that it won't be delegated until some certain point in time, assuming all technical criteria and so forth are met?
That's true, and I think that's true, and I think that some additional work needs to be done on variants, because to a certain extent variants are self-defining by the IDN tables that are submitted, and so, the application process relies on the applicant to identify variants, and they wouldn't be delegated to someone else. And I think in either case, if they're identified as a variant, even if they're not mentioned in the application, they would be identified perhaps and not delegated. But Dan wants to clarify.
Yeah, I just want to reiterate again what you said about that this, you're giving a high-level summary and just what Kurt's talking about. I mean, as you've seen, I'm sure it goes on for like two or three pages in the guidebook, and it's not quite as simple as Kurt is portraying it. So when Kurt's saying it wouldn't be delegated or it would be allocated, those aren't guarantees. That if you an applicant might list lots of strings, and just listing them as declared variants doesn't mean those would all be eligible for allocation, nor that somebody else might apply for them and get them. So it's just another warning that it's more complicated. And please look at the actual text and comment on the text and not on this kind of overview language.
Okay, just I guess a more direct way to ask a question. So if we are, can we assume that if the solution taken by .china in this particular respect would be acceptable for gTLDs?
Yeah, not right now. The guidebook says that variants wouldn't be allocated. The scheme is scheme has different connotations, but the synchronization plan, the synchronization plan was not really enacted. In other words, synchronization plan was published. There was a lot of comments. It was found to be confusing, and so the way in which .china variant TLD is being considered is through their implementation plan of resolving to the same place. I think what happens in the delegation request and then after that is going to really inform how we handle these going forward.
Thank you, Kurt. Christina.
Thanks, Kurt. Two questions. I'll make them very short. Under 1.1.2.4, if it turns out that the initial evaluation period ends up going past 5 months because of the volume of applications, do you anticipate that ICANN would extend the objection period accordingly, and if not, why not?
Do you remember the answer?
Yeah. So the objection period's meant, yeah, so I think the short answer is yes. The objection period tracks to the initial evaluation period. So for batches, so this is qualified, but you know, I think the objection period for the first batch would track to that initial evaluation, but the objection period for the second batch would remain open for the time taken to evaluate that batch too. I don't know. I'm sure we discussed this at one time, but I'm not spinning it up. But I see the negative results of not doing that being worse than the results of doing it.
The second question is that when a user registers with the system to designate the number of slots that they want in terms of applications, is that a one-time possibility? Or if it turns out that you do five and then you later decide you're going to do two more because you happen to work in a law firm and all of a sudden the clients realize, gee, I should do this, is there an opportunity to go back for the user to go back and re-enter the system and ask for additional, register for additional slots or whatever it is that you're calling it?
I think the short answer is yes, but up through the closing date.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Right.
Thank you very much, Christina, for keeping the questions really direct and to the point and brief. I'm going to encourage everyone who comments or asks a question to do that, because we're in Module 1. There are 6 modules, and there are a whole bunch of other documents that go with this, and we'd like to cover as much as we can today. Having said that, Stefan, it's your turn.
I love the way you say that before I speak.
I knew you'd appreciate that.
I just want to come back to the exact paragraph that Zahid was referencing earlier on in 1.1.2.3, just to make sure, if you can help me out, Kurt, make sure I understand exactly what you're proposing. There is what's been said all along that there would be no first-come, first-serve advantage within the actual cycle between the first and the 60th day. That is still the case. You say you get 300 applications and it's just you just handle them all. If you get more than 500, say you get 1,000, you randomly select. So there's no advantage in being there on the first day. You can come in on the 60th day. It's exactly the same thing, except if you're in a contention set, and then you go in the first batch. Is that what you said?
Unless it's Tuesday and there's a new moon. So yes, that's exactly what the guidebook says. Again, there could be some legal reasons for not doing a sort of random selection that might be thought to be a lottery of some sort. But no advantage to being first in line. You know, and I think the reasoning behind that is you don't want to encourage fast applications. You want to encourage good applications. So that's the thought.
Thank you. Not seeing any more counselors at the moment. Eric, it's your turn. Do you have a mic?
And I'd like to stand where I was told, but then I'd be addressing Kurt's back. Is this working?
Yes.
Okay, good. Hi, I'm Eric Brunner-Williams from Quark. Kurt, I have a question. In Section 1, there are two application types which are defined, the community-based application and the standard-based application. There is no other kind of application defined in the guidebook at this point in time. Do you anticipate adding any other type?
Yes.
Yes, I know. But you want me to repeat the question?
Yes.
Okay. There are two types of applications defined in the guidebook, standard and community-based. My question to Kurt is, does he anticipate adding a third type? Thank you.
Thanks, Eric. So the application process also allows for identification as a geographic name and describes that. There's a lot of talk about adding categories of TLDs. The guidebook doesn't, you know, include other categories of TLDs now, and you know, the guidebook. So the short answer is no, and the reason there's several reasons. One is we're trying to follow the policy recommendations that called for the creation of a community-based sort of application, And and secondly, I think there will be categories of TLDs, and it's good to let the right approach is what the council recommended, and that's to let the market self-identify its categories and create them. And you know, for many reasons, but one is that you know, for ICANN to create categories might stifle or hobble some sort of innovative approach there. And there's other cost administrative reasons for not doing it.
Thank you, Kurt.
Yes, Sahi.
The economic study talks about limited sort of rounds. And is there any use in sort of thinking about rationing or batches as opposed to random situations, and maybe sort of doing sort of limited rounds as we go along? That's what the economic study says. That's the bottom paragraph. So
right, and we talked a lot about that during the policy development process, and whether if we could restrict the rounds and rules around that, and the difficulties for those rules. Again, the first round is thought to be an open round. The economic study brings up a lot of possibilities, subsidizing some applications fees in order to realize the maximum social or net benefit or social benefit or social benefit plus private benefit or something like that. And then says right after that, boy, those things are really, really hard to do. But I think they're food for thought for subsequent rounds, how ICANN's going to maximize the benefit of TLDs in the long term. So right now I would look at the economic study as a menu of possibilities, and then the next step is for those guys to do some data gathering and empiric analysis to try to quantify what the net benefits of the new GTLD program are.
Thank you, Kurt. Let's go to Module 2.
Module 2 are the evaluation procedures. In a sense, they're the least talked about module, but probably the most important, because every applicant's going to go through that. And so it includes information on background checks for applicants, the criteria in initial evaluation, which are the six evaluations that are performed on each application, and information about the evaluation panels. And the changes here are the augmentation of background checks in accordance with public comment, and measures to mitigate potential malicious behavior. What was formerly the IDN-3 character requirement now is the IDN-2 character requirement. And the information necessary for one to apply for a geographic TLD. So background checks have been greatly enhanced with more detail, and covers the individuals and entities you see on the screen there, all the major players in the registry, and the background checks will be performed by a third party. So I think the background checks are a good example of the guidebook changing in response to public comment. The IDN-3 character requirement, the IDN implementation working team was one of those teams actually headed by a couple board members that undertook work on this and the variant management issue, and developed a solution that allows for registration of two-character IDN strings for GTLDs, and then decided for one-character strings that they still even in languages where there's thousands or tens of thousands of characters are kind of regarded as valuable oceanfront property, and so will be considered in they thought there should be some additional policy work done before those are allocated. So some accommodation made there in response to public comment. And then finally, or is there one after this? Geographic names. So a change here is that country and territory names won't be considered in the first round. So I think that decision, coupled with the ongoing CCNSO work, will point to, you know, provide a future direction. I think it's an important policy question coming up, and that is, you know, as a country name, can that be a GTLD or a CCTLD? I think it's an important question for the entire ICANN policymaking, for all of the ICANN policymaking organizations. And in addition to this change, there's clarification with regard to requirements for city names. And we've also put in a letter, a sample letter of government support. And, you know, if you sit in some other meetings, you certainly don't want to be telling governments what to do or what to write. But the purpose of it really is to inform governments as to what they're approving, so they can use or not use the format. And maybe governments will tell us, you know, we really don't want this in the guidebook at all. But the goal of it is to inform governments as to, you know, if you approve this, this is what's going to happen. So is that the end of the slide? So if there's questions about the second module.
Thank you very much, Kurt. I saw Christina and Mary and Wolf. Let's go ahead and keep your hands up if I haven't called you yet. I'll get you. Go ahead and start, Christina.
Mary and Wolf can go first.
Okay, Mary.
Thank you. Well, my question is on the new Section 2.1, which is the background check, and actually I have two specific questions, both to do with the breadth of language, or what to some in my SG consider breadth of language. The first is that the background checks that can include background checks on individuals, so say a director and officer of a corporation. We all understand that new GTLD applicants can't be individuals, so that's one thing. But that of the background checks of individuals, I think we can understand why it might be a problem if a director of a corporation engages in terrorism or serious organized crime. The last bullet point says intellectual property violations. First, what does that mean? Secondly, intellectual property encompasses more than just trademarks. So if, for example, that director happened, unfortunately, to not understand copyright law and got into trouble because he downloaded something from BitTorrent, technically that could come within this section. That may not have been the intent, but that certainly could be the implication. So that was my first question. My second question goes to the next bullet point about scenarios where the applicant may not pass the background check, including where there's been liability found in a series of cyber squatting proceedings. And again, I think we understand the intent, the serial cyber squatter problem that all of us have been talking about for over a year. Our question for that is that by this language, this clearly seems to include both default as well as non-default judgments, not just court decisions, but also UDRP panel decisions. And our concern, again, is that that may be too broad.
Right. So thank you, Mary. So those are excellent points. And so the two points I want to make in return are that the background check may include but not be limited to the following areas. So the background check would inquire into intellectual property violations, which, you know, as I remember our discussions, mean UDRP findings, for example, against a person, or a finding of cyber squatting violations. So that doesn't necessarily bar the application, right? That's just the inquiry, and then a determination is made. You know, are these violations sufficiently numerous or evil to say that that person shouldn't be operating a TLD? So then, what I'm hearing you say is that the guidebook might attempt to include some objective sort of test or criteria, so that you know, that, you know, one finding of UDRP you know, UDRP loss or something you say about downloading something in violation wouldn't bar you, that the guidebook should be more specific in the level to which these violations have to rise before an applicant would be barred.
And I won't take up more time. We can talk about this offline, public comments and so forth, but at the very least, more specificity and certainly more narrowness in terms of what's to be covered in those checks.
Now, Mary mentioned something that I want to remind everybody of that we've talked about in previous sessions like this, and that is it's really wise to submit your comments in writing in addition to in this meeting. So I certainly encourage you to do both if at all possible. And next in queue is Wolf.
Thanks, Chuck. Well, just to add one question with regards to the background check, as you include these terrorism and all these the other things. So who is supposed to conduct this background check? Is there any idea about that? Is it a secret service? Is it what do you have in mind? So this is one question. The second question is with regard to the definition, for example, for terrorism. So that is fully open to me. What kind of definition is behind all that? Thanks.
So who is going to conduct a background check isn't ascertained yet. You know, certainly it's an independent third party that is that does this sort of work. You can imagine working at ICANN when the background check was performed against me. It was an Australian firm, and now ICANN employs other firms to do those checks. So if you have specific ideas about this, you know, I defer to Karen or Dan to add more about who's going to perform the background checks, but it's certainly not my area of expertise. And there are people in, you know, employees of ICANN and then firms ICANN employs that are suited to, better suited to answer that question. And then, you know, I don't know what to say about terrorism. I know terrorism is bad. And so I think we'll supply a form and ask the applicant if they've ever committed acts of terrorism, and if they have, you know, they're straight out.
Okay, Edmund, and you're next.
Thank you, Chuck. Again, two questions. First one.